A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to talk about what goes into painting a commercial airliner. The chemistry, the engineering, the sheer logistical puzzle of coating something the size of 4 tennis courts in a finish that survives minus 55 at altitude, plus 50 on the tarmac in Dubai, and rain erosion at 500 knots. And he's right. It's one of those processes that's completely invisible to passengers, but genuinely astonishing once you look at it.
250 to 300 pounds. That's how much paint a fully liveried 737 carries. It's the weight of an extra passenger permanently bolted to the airframe, and every pound costs fuel. Airlines obsess over this number.
The paint job is literally a line item on the fuel budget.
At today's jet fuel prices, around $2.50 a gallon, that extra 300 pounds costs roughly $3,000 per aircraft per year in fuel. Multiply that across a fleet of 700 aircraft and you're looking at real money. And that's before we even get to the cost of actually applying the paint.
Which, from what I've read, is somewhere between a luxury car and a small house.
A full repaint runs $150,000 to $300,000 per aircraft. Takes 7 to 14 days. American Airlines AstroJet livery program a couple years back, their 777s needed 14 days each, 80 gallons of paint, 40 gallons of primer, $200,000 a plane.
Let me put that in perspective for listeners. You're telling me that painting one 777 costs more than the median home in a lot of American cities, and they do this every 5 to 7 years per aircraft across fleets of hundreds. What's the total annual paint spend for a major carrier?
For someone like Delta or United, you're looking at tens of millions annually just on paint and paint-related labor. It's a significant operational expense. And it's not optional. You can't just decide to skip a repaint cycle and run the aircraft a few more years.
Which brings us to the obvious question. So why does a 737 need a paint job that costs more than a house? Let's start with the scale of the problem. A 737-800 has about 1,100 square meters of surface area. That's roughly 4 tennis courts. Every square inch has to be coated uniformly, and the coating has to survive conditions that would destroy automotive paint in a single flight.
This is where most people get it wrong. They think aircraft paint is just car paint but more expensive. It's not. Car paint uses acrylic or polyester resins. Aircraft paint uses cross-linked polyurethanes and epoxies that are chemically engineered for a completely different set of demands.
What kind of demands are we talking about?
Temperature swings from minus 55 Celsius at 40,000 feet to plus 50 Celsius sitting on the tarmac in the Middle East. That's 105 degree delta. UV bombardment at altitude, where there's less atmosphere to filter it. And I mean real UV, not what gives you a sunburn at the beach. Hydraulic fluid, Skydrol specifically, which is aggressively solvent-like and will strip most coatings on contact. Rain erosion at 500 knots, which is basically sandblasting with water. De-icing fluids like propylene glycol that can soften certain polymers. And through all of that, the paint has to keep protecting the aluminum underneath from corrosion.
It's a protective system that happens to look like a livery, not a livery that happens to protect.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. The primer underneath the color coat contains corrosion inhibitors, historically hexavalent chromium compounds, specifically strontium chromate, that actively protect the aluminum airframe from galvanic corrosion. Without that paint system, an aircraft would corrode rapidly, especially around the dissimilar metal fasteners where steel meets aluminum.
Galvanic corrosion being what happens when you have two different metals in contact with an electrolyte, and one essentially becomes a sacrificial anode.
The aluminum airframe and steel fasteners create a tiny battery whenever moisture is present. The aluminum corrodes preferentially, and at altitude you get condensation cycling every time the aircraft descends into warmer, more humid air. It's a corrosion engineer's nightmare. Think about it. The aircraft climbs to 40,000 feet, the skin gets cold soaked, Then it descends into humid air at the destination, and moisture condenses on every surface, including inside lap joints and around fasteners. That happens multiple times a day, every day, for years.
Before a single drop of color touches the aluminum, there's a chemical dance that happens first.
Surface preparation is everything. It's 80% of the battle. You can apply the most advanced polyurethane top coat in the world, but if the surface underneath isn't properly prepared, it'll peel off within months. I've seen it happen. A $1 million paint job ruined because someone rushed the prep work.
What does proper preparation actually involve? Walk me through it step by step.
The first step is stripping the old paint. For decades, the industry standard was chemical stripping using methyl ethyl ketone, MEK, which is an incredibly effective solvent. But in 2025, both the FII and EASA updated their guidance restricting MEK use because of occupational exposure and environmental concerns. That forced reformulation of paint strippers across the industry. These days, facilities use a combination of less aggressive chemical strippers and media blasting, essentially shooting tiny particles at the surface to mechanically remove old paint.
Which presumably introduces its own challenges. You're blasting an aluminum airframe with abrasive particles.
You have to be extremely careful. Too aggressive and you damage the aluminum skin. Too gentle and you leave old coating behind, which creates adhesion problems for the new paint. It's a precision process. And you're doing this on a surface the size of 4 tennis courts, much of it curved, with rivets and seams and access panels everywhere. Once the old paint is off, you inspect every square inch for corrosion, cracks, or damage. Then comes the conversion coating.
This is the Allodyne process?
Allodyne is the trade name. It's a chromate conversion coating. You apply a solution containing hexavalent chromium compounds to the bare aluminum. It reacts with the surface to create a passive oxide layer that does two things. One, it provides corrosion resistance by itself. Two, it creates a microscopically rough surface that mechanically interlocks with the primer. And three things. It provides hydroxyl groups on the aluminum oxide surface that chemically bond with the epoxy resin in the primer.
It's a chemical primer for the primer.
That's a perfect way to put it. It's a chemical bridge between the metal and the organic coating. Without it, you're relying purely on mechanical adhesion, and that fails under thermal cycling because aluminum and epoxy expand and contract at different rates. Aluminum's coefficient of thermal expansion is about 23 parts per million per degree Celsius. Epoxy is closer to 50 or 60. Over a 100 degree temperature swing, those differences add up to real stress at the interface.
The conversion coating is essentially accommodating that mismatch.
It's absorbing the strain. The chromate layer is inorganic, so it doesn't expand and contract the way the organic polymer does. It's a buffer zone.
There's been a regulatory push to move away from hexavalent chromium, hasn't there?
Hexavalent chromium is a known carcinogen. The 2024 to 2025 regulatory cycle saw serious pressure to replace it with trivalent chromium or non-chromate alternatives like zinc molybdate. The problem is performance. Hexavalent chromium has this remarkable property where it leaches slowly from the primer over time, so if the coating gets scratched, chromium ions migrate to the exposed area and passivate it. They essentially heal the scratch.
Self-healing paint, decades before microcapsules.
The non-chromate alternatives don't do that. Zinc molybdate provides good barrier protection but doesn't have the same active healing mechanism. So you trade safety during application, protecting the workers in the paint facility against long-term corrosion protection. It's a genuine engineering tension, not just a regulatory checkbox.
How do airlines actually navigate that tension in practice? Are they switching or sticking with chromates?
It depends on the regulatory jurisdiction and the aircraft type. European operators under EASA have been moving faster toward non-chromate systems. Operators have been more conservative, partly because the FIA's acceptance of alternatives has been slower, and partly because the performance data on long-term corrosion protection with non-chromate primers is still being gathered. Nobody wants to be the airline that discovers, 10 years from now, that their fleet has widespread hidden corrosion because they switched primers too early.
Once the conversion coating is applied, then comes the primer.
Two-part epoxy primers. PPG. Desethane HS is one of the industry standards. You mix an epoxy resin with an amine curing agent just before spraying, and the chemical reaction starts. The epoxy groups react with the amine to form a cross-linked three-dimensional network. And this is key, that cross-linked structure is what gives epoxies their chemical and mechanical resistance.
Why epoxy specifically for the primer layer?
Adhesion and corrosion protection. The epoxy bonds chemically to those hydroxyl groups on the conversion coating, and it's an excellent vehicle for carrying the chromate corrosion inhibitors. It also provides a slightly flexible base that can accommodate the thermal expansion differences between the aluminum and the harder polyurethane top coat.
You've got this layered system where each layer has a specific chemical job, and they all have to work together.
Each one depends on the layer beneath it. If the conversion coating is patchy, the primer won't bond evenly. If the primer is too thin, you lose corrosion protection in that area. If the primer is too thick, it adds weight. The spec for primer thickness on a commercial airliner is typically 0.8 to 1.2 mils. That's thousandths of an inch. It's incredibly precise. For context, a human hair is about 2 to 3 mils thick. So we're talking about a primer layer that's thinner than a hair, applied uniformly over 1,100 square meters.
That's absurd. How do you even measure something that thin across a surface that large?
Eddy current thickness gauges. You place a probe on the surface, it induces a current in the aluminum underneath, and the instrument calculates the coating thickness based on the electrical response. Inspectors walk the entire aircraft taking hundreds of measurements. If any area is below spec, it gets another pass with the spray gun.
Now we get to the top coat. This is the polyurethane layer that actually carries the color and the livery design.
This is where the chemistry gets really interesting. Aerospace polyurethanes. AkzoNobel Aerodur is another major product, are based on a reaction between isocyanates and polyols. When you mix them, the isocyanate groups react with the hydroxyl groups on the polyol to form urethane linkages. As the reaction proceeds, you get a densely cross-linked polymer network.
Why polyurethane over, say, acrylic enamel?
Flexibility at low temperatures, UV resistance, and chemical resistance. Acrylics get brittle at minus 55. They'll crack. Polyurethane stays flexible because the cross-linked network can absorb mechanical stress without fracturing. For UV resistance, polyurethanes are formulated with hindered amine light stabilizers, HALS, that absorb UV photons and dissipate the energy as heat rather than letting it break chemical bonds in the polymer.
It's got built-in sunscreen.
Chemically engineered sunscreen, yes. And it's not just a single UV absorber slapped in. A typical aerospace polyurethane formulation might contain 3 or 4 different HALS compounds, each optimized for a different part of the UV spectrum. They work synergistically. And then there's the chemical resistance. Skydrol hydraulic fluid is a phosphate ester-based fluid that's incredibly aggressive. It'll dissolve acrylics, it'll attack polyester resins, it'll soften epoxies over time. Polyurethane swells slightly on contact with Skydrol, but doesn't dissolve. Once the fluid evaporates or is cleaned off, the polyurethane returns to its original state.
That's a high bar, surviving what is essentially industrial solvent.
It has to do it repeatedly, for years, across thousands of flight cycles. A typical livery lasts 5 to 7 years before the aircraft needs a full repaint.
What actually drives the repaint cycle? Is it aesthetics, or does the paint stop protecting the aircraft?
Both, but protection is the primary driver. The main failure modes are chalking, erosion, and chemical degradation. Chalking is what happens when UV radiation breaks down the resin at the surface. You get a white, powdery layer of degraded polymer. It doesn't necessarily compromise protection immediately, but it's a sign that the UV stabilizers are depleted. Erosion is mechanical. Rain and dust impact at high speed literally wears away the coating. You see it most on leading edges of wings, the nose cone, and engine nacelles.
The parts that hit the air first.
Those areas are repainted more frequently than the rest of the aircraft. Next time you're on the tarmac, look at the leading edges of the wings. You'll often see they're slightly different in appearance because they've been touched up between full repaint cycles. And then there's chemical attack from de-icing fluids. Propylene glycol, which is the main de-icing fluid, can soften polyurethane over repeated exposure. Aircraft that operate extensively in cold climates, think Canadian routes, Northern European routes, tend to need repainting sooner.
We've got a perfectly primed, chemically bonded surface. Now comes the fun part, actually applying the livery.
This is where it goes from chemistry to art and logistics. Complex livery designs, think the Eurowings Yellow Belly or any of the retro jet schemes, are applied using a combination of stencils, vinyl masks, and increasingly, computer-guided spray robots.
I was going to ask about the robots. Is this still a hand-sprayed process?
It's a mix. The base coats are increasingly applied by robotic systems because they can maintain consistent thickness and coverage across the entire airframe. But the detailed livery work, the logos, the curves, the registration numbers, still involves skilled human painters using stencils and masks. A full livery can involve dozens of individual stencils. I've seen time-lapse videos of a 787 being painted, and it looks like a combination of an automotive paint booth and a fine art studio.
The color matching? You're painting an aircraft that might be next to another aircraft from the same fleet, and they need to look identical.
Metamerism is the nightmare. That's when two colors match under one light source, say the hangar's fluorescent lights, but look completely different under another, like sunlight on the tarmac. Paint manufacturers have to formulate colors that are metamerism resistant, which means the spectral reflectance curves have to match, not just the visual appearance under one light source.
You can't just use a Pantone code and call it a day.
Not even close. Each batch of paint has to be spectrophotometrically matched to the master standard. And because polyurethane paint continues to cure and shift slightly in color for weeks after application, you have to account for that drift. It's one of the harder color matching problems in industrial coatings. Automotive paint has the same issue, but cars are smaller and you're not typically parking two cars from different paint batches right next to each other at 60 miles an hour. Aircraft from different paint cycles end up side by side at gates constantly.
You could have an aircraft painted in Singapore and another painted in Dallas, and they need to look identical when they're parked next to each other at Heathrow.
And they were painted months apart, possibly with different batches of paint by different crews, under different humidity conditions. The fact that airlines achieve visual consistency at all is kind of remarkable.
Then there's the curing process. This isn't just leaving the aircraft in a hangar and waiting.
After each coat, primer, base color, livery details, clear coat, the aircraft is moved into a temperature-controlled hangar at 70 to 80 degrees Fahrenheit for 8 to 12 hours. Some facilities use infrared heaters to accelerate the cross-linking reaction. You can't rush it too much because if the surface cures faster than the underlying layers, you get solvent entrapment, bubbles or blisters under the paint.
Trap moisture under the paint causing corrosion. That's what happened with the Qantas A380 incident.
In 2010, Qantas Flight 32 had an uncontained engine failure, a rotor burst on a Rolls-Royce Trent 900 engine. During the fleet-wide inspection that followed, they found paint blistering on some aircraft. The root cause was trapped moisture under the paint, which had caused corrosion that was hidden until the paint blistered. That incident drove major changes to primer application humidity controls across the industry. Now, paint facilities monitor ambient humidity obsessively, and the aluminum surface has to be verified dry. Not just visibly dry, but measured with surface moisture meters before primer is applied.
A $400 million aircraft brought down by humidity in a paint hangar. Well, not brought down, but...
And that's the thing about aircraft paint. It's not just about looking good. It's a safety-critical system. Corrosion hidden under paint can become a structural issue if it's not caught.
Let's talk about the weight engineering side, because that's where the economics get fascinating.
Every gallon of paint weighs about 10 to 12 pounds. A full livery, primer, base coat, and clear coat is 250 to 300 pounds across the entire aircraft, and airlines have done the math obsessively. Delta and Ryanair have both experimented with stripping paint from certain surfaces, particularly the belly, to save weight.
The Southwest bare metal experiment is the classic case study here.
It's the perfect example of the trade-off. In the 1990s, Southwest Airlines experimented with polished aluminum, no paint at all on large portions of the aircraft, just the bare metal polished to a shine. They saved about 150 pounds per aircraft compared to a full paint job, which translated to meaningful fuel savings across their fleet, but they eventually abandoned it.
Because the maintenance costs ate the fuel savings.
Bare aluminum corrodes. You have to polish it constantly. You have to inspect it more frequently. You have to treat corrosion spots when they appear. And the labor costs for all that maintenance exceeded the fuel savings. The paint, for all its weight and cost, was actually the cheaper option over the life of the aircraft.
Which is a beautiful example of systems thinking. You can't optimize one variable, weight, without understanding how it connects to maintenance, corrosion, inspection intervals, labor costs, and aircraft downtime.
That's why every major airline today paints their aircraft. The math has been done. The protective value of the coating system outweighs its weight penalty.
It does make me wonder, are there airlines that go the other direction, that use heavier paint applications for longer durability?
Cargo carriers sometimes do this. They're less concerned about aesthetics and more concerned about maximizing the interval between repaints. A FedEx or UPS aircraft might get a slightly thicker coating with the logic that the added weight is offset by fewer days out of service for repainting over the aircraft's life. Different operators optimize for different variables.
What about emerging technologies? What's coming down the pipeline?
A few things. PPG has developed something called Aerocron, which is an electroquate primer applied like automotive e-coat using electrodeposition. You submerge the part or spray it and apply an electric current, and the charged paint particles migrate uniformly to the surface. It gives incredibly even coverage on complex shapes, which is hard to achieve with spray application.
Like powder coating but wet.
Electrodeposition has been used in automotive manufacturing for decades, but adapting it to aircraft-scale components with aerospace-grade epoxies is new. Sherwin-Williams has Aerolon, which is a low VOC polyurethane formulated to meet the 2025 EPIAM rules, architectural and industrial maintenance coatings regulations that tightened volatile organic compound limits.
Graphene is showing up everywhere, including aircraft paint apparently.
Both Airbus and Boeing R&D groups are investigating graphene-infused top coats. The main application is anti-static properties. When an aircraft flies through certain atmospheric conditions, it builds up static charge. Normally, that dissipates through static wicks on the trailing edges, but a conductive top coat could distribute the charge more evenly and potentially reduce lightning strike damage.
Lightning strikes being a regular occurrence for commercial aircraft.
The average commercial airliner gets struck by lightning about once a year. It's designed to handle it. The aluminum skin acts as a Faraday cage, but the paint at the strike point gets vaporized. A more conductive paint could reduce the localized damage.
There's also the self-healing paint research.
Fraunhofer Institute published work in 2024 on microcapsule-based self-healing clear coats. The idea is you embed tiny capsules filled with a healing agent, typically a liquid monomer or resin, throughout the clear coat. When a crack forms, it ruptures the capsules. The healing agent flows into the crack, and it polymerizes on contact with air or with a catalyst also embedded in the coating.
Like platelets in blood.
Exactly the same mechanism. The problem for aviation is twofold. One, the microcapsules add weight, not a lot, but every gram counts when you're talking about coating 1,100 square meters. You have to prove that the self-healing mechanism works reliably across the full temperature range, doesn't interfere with the other coating layers, and doesn't degrade over the 5 to 7 year service life. Nobody's cracked that yet.
We're still a ways off from aircraft that heal their own scratches.
Probably a decade or more before we see it in commercial aviation. Military applications might come sooner. They're willing to pay a premium for reduced maintenance.
All of this chemistry and engineering boils down to a few principles you can apply to any coating challenge. What are the big ones?
First, substrate preparation is 80% of the battle. The best top coat in the world won't save a poorly prepared surface. The conversion coating, the cleaning, the moisture control, that's where adhesion is won or lost.
Like any relationship, really, it's all about what happens before the top layer goes on.
Second, cross-linked polymers are the workhorses of extreme condition coatings. Epoxies and polyurethanes form three-dimensional networks that resist solvents, temperature swings, and mechanical stress in ways that linear polymers, thermoplastics, simply can't. It's the cross-linking that makes the difference.
The chemical equivalent of rebar in concrete.
Third, there's no free lunch. Every design choice is a trade-off. Chromates give you self-healing corrosion protection, but they're toxic to the workers applying them. Bare metal saves weight, but increases maintenance costs. Thicker paint protects better, but burns more fuel. The entire industry is a constant optimization problem.
Fourth, the paint is not cosmetic. It's a protective system that happens to be colorful. The corrosion inhibitors in the primer are actively protecting a multi-million dollar aluminum structure from galvanic corrosion every single flight.
If you take one thing away from this, it's that. Next time you see an aircraft on the tarmac, look at the leading edges of the wings and the engine nacelles. Those areas are repainted more frequently than the rest of the aircraft because of erosion. That's a visible clue to the physics of flight. The places where the air hits hardest are the places where the paint wears fastest.
It's a wear indicator for the invisible forces acting on the aircraft.
It tells you something about how brutal the environment is at 500 knots. Rain isn't just rain at that speed. It's a high-velocity abrasive.
Where does this go in the next decade? You mentioned the 2030 net zero targets.
Every pound of paint will be scrutinized. We may see a shift to thinner, multifunctional coatings that combine primer, color, and UV protection in a single layer. The PPG Electrocoat approach points in that direction. One uniform coating that does everything. You lose some of the layered optimization, but you save significant weight.
A single coating that does the job of three layers. That's a material science challenge.
You need a polymer that provides corrosion inhibition, UV resistance, color stability, and mechanical durability all in one formulation. Nobody's quite there yet, but the regulatory pressure and the fuel cost pressure are both pushing hard in that direction.
What about the self-healing question? Will we ever see it?
I think we will eventually, but not in the form most people imagine. The microcapsule approach is elegant in the lab, but hard to scale. The more likely path is intrinsic self-healing, polymers designed with reversible crosslinks that can reform after being broken. There's work on Diels-Alder reactions, where the crosslinks break under mechanical stress but reform when heated. Imagine an aircraft that goes through a bake cycle during heavy maintenance and the paint essentially reheals its microcracks.
You park the aircraft in a heated hangar for a maintenance check, and the paint fixes itself while you're inspecting the engines.
That's the vision. It's not science fiction. The chemistry works in the lab. The challenge is making it durable enough for aviation and cost-effective enough for commercial operators.
That's where we'll leave it, wondering whether the 737 of 2040 will heal its own scratches while sitting on the tarmac in Dubai. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
By 1805, the Russian Empire's postal service had established over 3,200 post offices across its territory, but fewer than 40 of them were located in the entire Caspian Basin region, an area roughly the size of France, making a letter from Astrakhan to Baku a journey that could take 3 months.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, rate us 5 stars and tell a friend who loves aviation or chemistry. We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.